This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Keeping Up with the Kafashians, the place where the threads of medical expertise weave into the fabric of family life. I'm Afif, a neonatologist deeply intrigued by the earliest stages of life and how our beginnings shape us.
And I'm Anne, an obstetric anesthesiologist with a heart firmly rooted in maternal health and well-being. My passion lies in ensuring safety and comfort during one of life's most remarkable journeys, childbirth.
Together, we navigate the intricate journey of professional practice and personal experience, especially as it pertains to parenting, health, and the profound experience of raising children.
Each episode, we invite you into conversations that bridge the gap between science and the living room, sharing insights from our fields, stories from our lives, and discussions that connect with everyone, from healthcare professionals to parents and those interested in the marvels of human development.
We're here to explore, to question, and to celebrate the incredible journey of life, from the first heartbeat to the first steps and beyond. Welcome to Keeping Up with the Kafashians.
Let's begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Keeping Up with the Kafashians, episode 7.
Seven.
And wow. Today is a very momentous occasion because...
today's our anniversary. See, I remembered.
You remembered. Today is our wedding anniversary. Mm-hmm. We are married 17 years. We know each other 19 years. Yeah. It's an eternity.
An eternity.
Yeah. Well, wow. So, you know, when we went out for a lovely dinner yesterday mm-hmm. at a restaurant.
It was very good.
You're hearing this on a Tuesday, but we're recording this on the Sunday. So our wedding anniversary is on the Sunday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the lady found out that we were married 17 years, she was so surprised. And she was like, guys, you look like you've only been married 2 years. That's how well I look after you. You look so young and stay so young all the time.
I'm wondering where he's going with this because this isn't the typical Afif interaction. Go on.
That's it. I just wanted to let our listeners know how well I look after you.
Oh, I knew it had to be something based on you. Okay, go on. Yeah. I think we look after each other fairly well.
We do. And how sad are we doing this during our wedding anniversary?
Oh, this is one of the things you like to do now. So I think this is an appropriate way to spend it.
Thank you so much for continuing to listen. Thank you so much for your support. We really hope that you're finding value. And by the way, actually, if you are listening to the 6 listeners now,
I know who the person, who the non-Ballina listener is.
Yeah, so we know we're not gonna say who it is, but you know who you are. So thank you so much.
Shout out.
Please, to all our 6 listeners, actually give us a rating and give us a review, because that would actually help us, you know, reach more people. I know we're behind the paywall, but rating and reviewing, we got one 5-star rating, by the way.
Oh, did we?
On Spotify, yeah.
Was that for me? I actually haven't rated us.
Oh yeah, you should.
I should rate us.
Yeah, you should rate us.
Oh my god! Yeah,
please give us a rating, so we'll get another 5-star review. This week's Baby Tribe episode is quite a good episode. Mm-hmm. April is Autism Awareness Month.
Yeah,
and we had an amazing interview with an amazing clinical psychologist, Dr. Rebecca Quinn, and we talked about autism. We talked about temper tantrums. And we talked about
temper tantrums as a normal variant of life as well.
Yes. So we talked about temper tantrums.
Like when a thief goes off on one.
Yes. I don't have temper tantrums.
Okay.
You have temper tantrums.
I don't.
You have meltdowns.
I don't have meltdowns. Oh my God.
Now I know the difference between the two because Dr. Quinn explained it for me very well.
I have a moderate frustration tolerance, I'll give you that much.
Yeah. Mm. I do have temper tantrums sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah, but they don't last long. Mm. And many people sometimes think that, you know, the presence of temper tantrums in, you know, young toddlers and children can be a sign of things to come in terms of, you know, neurological issues and other conditions. Mm. And that is not always the case.
No, it's a growth phase. It's a phase where they have to find their frustration tolerance. I found mine is moderate.
Yes. And we also discussed a lot of myths that are associated with autism.
Yeah, that's really important.
Yeah, the big one that we discussed on the main podcast was vaccinations and how, you know, the original paper that came out linking the MMR vaccine to autism did a lot of damage. It has been debunked. We're not going to dwell on it on this episode because we talk about it in detail. On so if you haven't listened, go back to the Baby Tribe podcast and listen to it. But what myself and Anne are going to talk about today are two other myths and associations between things that pregnant women may take or may avail of in and around delivery and autism. And but before we go into that,
I was going to say something.
Yes, go
I
on.
I actually haven't told you this, but I was said, oh, I'll save it for the pod. I'm not doing that. God help us.
Go on.
So do you know what our childminder said to me about, I think it was last week when I was starting to look into this stuff?
What did she say to us?
She said, you know the way people talk about neurospicy, neurobland kind of, and it's that neurodivergent, neurotypical kind of equivalence, right? She goes, you're not the most neurobland household I've ever worked in. And I was like, really? And she said, yeah. She goes, there are times where I listen to you talk to each other and I'm like, how the hell did they go down that avenue? Because I suppose we don't notice it because it's just our house and our family, you know? But then she started giving me all these random examples and I was like, oh yeah. And I suppose it just illustrated to me that it's a normal, like there's a whole spectrum of normal variation out there of people who are more anxious, people who are a little bit more routine dependent, people who are more kind of toward the ADD side of things. Now, I don't say I don't think I have ADD, but I would definitely be geared toward that end of the personality spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, and it just brought home to me the concept that, you know, neurotypical is a really broad spectrum of normal anyway.
Yeah.
And then the disorder end of things is when you can't function on a day to day basis because those tendencies become so great in your life that they are actually determining your day to day living.
Yeah.
And I think that it's so common now for people to identify with neurodivergence. That I think,
or some traits,
exactly, that we need to kind of hone down are everybody's got some traits and they're there for a variety of different reasons. And it's not always a genetic issue that has then become exposed in the environment and then becomes this disorder, you know. So I think it's something that is going to be a work in progress for the next 10 years, I'd say, in society.
And I was just, before you were going to say that, going to reminisce about some of the temper tantrums our children.
Oh, the three good ones.
Used to have.
God bless them.
The big one that my poor daughter.
The princess puzzle.
The princess puzzle.
Now you have to say it, the princess puzzle, because you couldn't say your oars at the time.
The princess puzzle. Now, our daughter was strong-willed, to say the least.
Oh, she was feisty.
She didn't lick it off the floor.
Yeah, I like feisty girls.
Yeah, but she was a little bit too feisty to manage sometimes. And, you know, we really realized how feisty she was when, I suppose, you know, given that she has a, you know, a Palestinian dad and an Irish mother, like she was pretty screwed in terms of being fiery, in fairness. Let's admit that in terms of...
We are peoples who would know their boundaries and are culturally, you know, invested in expressing that. Yeah.
Yeah. So she never shied away of expressing how she felt. And it really became obvious when she was thrown in the mix with all the poor Canadian timid children in all the crèches. Sure. And every other day to get a phone call. Guys, she did it again.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, my God.
Oh. My God, yeah.
My favorite maneuver she used to do.
Oh, I was thinking of this the other day. God.
Was when she used to goad somebody and they'd run after her. And then she'd stop all of a sudden, turn around, stick her hand out and let their face run smack into her hand.
Yeah.
And then they'd collapse on the floor and just go, ha ha.
Yeah.
She was two.
Yeah.
She was two.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was her signature move. Yeah, that was her signature move.
But you have to tell them about the princess puzzle.
The princess puzzle. Oh, yeah. She used to never listen to us.
She coexisted with us, is how I would put it, with that girl.
Yeah.
She coexisted with us in that, you know, we got on with our lives and she kind of got on with her life. And then she would just throw down if our lives got in the way of her life.
Yeah. So I asked her that day. She was doing a princess puzzle. She was done. And I was like, Maggie, can you clean this up? No. And Maggie, can you please clean this up? No, Baba, my not going to. And I actually then gave her a warning that I said, if you don't clean this up, the princess puzzle is going in the bin. And she didn't believe me.
Yeah. Now, this wasn't an isolated occasion. This was becoming a pattern of, you know, you'll do what I tell you. And she was telling us what to do.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't anything, any idea of that, like no idea that she would be kind of pulling her own weight.
Yeah.
You know?
So let me set the scene. We were living on the 13th floor in a building in downtown Toronto. And by the way, just digressing, it was one of the few buildings that had a 13th floor.
Yeah, that's true.
In Toronto. Most of the buildings in Toronto went from 12 to 14.
14, yeah.
Yeah, but we actually were in 1310.
Yep.
You know, 13th floor, apartment 10. Everybody, when we gave them the address, were like, really, guys? You have a 13th floor?
This is true.
Yeah, we had a 13th floor. But anyway, the way we got rid of our garbage, that's how we used to call that, what we used to call rubbish, was we used to throw it down the chute, down the hall outside the apartment. And it was quite satisfactory, actually, you know, just throwing the little bin and you could hear it going. But anyway, I digress. So I said to her,
okay. You're a bit sensory there, Afif. Go on.
I was like, last time, Maggie, if you don't clean this up, this is going in the bin. And she said, no, Baba, am I not going to clean this up? I said, fine. So I gathered all the princess puzzles, the box, put it in a plastic bag.
In front of her.
In front of her. And I could see her look turn from determination to wonder.
Oh, yeah.
To fear. To despair. And then she started throwing a temper
Absolute
tantrum.
Wobbly. Yep.
So, and I said, no. I said, okay, at this stage, I'm committed. I am going
You were in it like for the long haul at that stage, Afif.
So I grabbed her with one arm.
Yep.
And I grabbed the bag with another arm, brought this kicking and screaming child down the hall, put the whole princess puzzle down the chute. I said, Maggie, it's gone forever.
Forever.
Forever. And you know what? She feckin' cleaned up.
Oh, she did after that. And after to that. This day, she still talks about the princess puzzle.
To this day, she's going to be 16 in a couple of weeks. She still says, Dad, do you remember the time you threw away my princess puzzle?
Yeah, actually, she's currently cleaning her room as we speak.
Yeah. So there you go.
She used to pick a fight with me every single morning at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
It was like part of her wake up morning routine.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then our son and his supermarket tantrums.
He was the guy who would lie on the ground and fake cry and scream. And I was the mother who would just step over him and become incredibly interested in what was on the shelf near him. But you couldn't make eye contact. You couldn't pay him any attention. You were just going to encourage it. It was going to get longer and longer if you gave him any attention. Yeah, so we've been there. He was tough. We spent time with our daughter. You could set boundaries where she would feel like she was going to be punished if, you know, there was a degree of escalation you could impose on her for bad behavior. And with our son, he would make the calculated decision of, was it worth it? Probably. And he would whack his sister anyway. And I'd be like, do not do that. If you do that, you will have to go and sit on the naughty step until you're properly sorry. And he would just look at me and then he'd be like, worth it. And he'd whack her across the head and I put him in the naughty step and no difference. Made no difference.
He used to ask what the punishment was.
It's going to be just so he could weigh it up.
He would ask, what are the consequences for my following actions? Yeah. And then you'd lay them out and he would actually take a few minutes to consider whether it is worth pursuing said action or not. And 99% of the time,
he went ahead.
He went ahead because the punishment was never severe enough.
Until he got into gadgets and gizmos.
Yeah.
And once he got into gadgets and gizmos, oh, we knew where he lived.
Yeah.
It was a joy.
Yeah.
He would wail. I couldn't be happier.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is our little snapshot of our temper tantruming children and how we dealt with it. But today we are going to briefly talk about the link between number one, paracetamol intake during the pregnancy and autism, and number two, the use of epidurals and autism. Both have been linked with autism in the children.
Both have been linked in past studies.
Yes. And this is why we need to address it, because we need to debunk a couple of those associations.
Before people in pregnancy feel even worse about trying to keep everything strong and normal and look after themselves.
Yeah,
good
so way. I'm going to start with my part. I'm going to do the paracetamol.
Cool. And you're going to do the epidural bits.
You're going to do the epidurals.
Makes sense.
Interestingly, the use of paracetamol is quite common during pregnancy. And so the US Food and Drug Administration, the European Medicines Agency, considered the use of paracetamol to pose minimal risk to the fetus if the mother availed of paracetamol for pain relief, for whatever the reason was. But interestingly, then in 2021, there was a consensus statement that came out cautioning against the use of paracetamol during pregnancy due to the potential risk of developmental disorders such as autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and other neurological issues. And they really recommended that only use it if it's absolutely necessary. And I really feel for pregnant moms. We keep telling them what they can't do. We keep telling them, you can't do this for pain relief. We almost say that you just have to put up with it without actually doing the proper research. So that's why I was really, really happy when this study came out, because up until then, there were so many biases and confounding factors in all of those studies linking paracetamol intake during pregnancy and autism and ADHD. A lot of confounding that wasn't really taken into consideration. Yeah. Almost like, was it a lazy way of doing research? Probably, maybe it wasn't just thorough enough. So that's why I really loved this study that was only published last week in JAMA, hot off the press, guys, looking at the association between paracetamol intake and autism, ADHD, and other neurological issues. But what they actually did this time, and one of the standout aspects of the study, was the fact that they actually used sibling control analysis.
Yeah.
So what that means is that using sibling controls, meaning that they looked at so many different families and they looked at occasions when a mother that may have taken paracetamol during the first pregnancy did not take paracetamol during a subsequent pregnancy.
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa, whereby the other sibling was not exposed to paracetamol.
Yeah, and so they have two siblings, same genetic parents, most important thing, and similar environments in early childhood. And the one difference between the two siblings is that one of them was exposed to paracetamol in pregnancy and one wasn't. That simple.
And this approach actually allows researchers to control for genetic and environmental factors that are shared by siblings, providing a clearer picture of the effect of paracetamol independent of family-related confounding factors.
Yeah.
So the beauty of this analysis is that even characteristics and factors that you may not be thinking of, doing the sibling analysis will adjust for these unknown confounders as well.
Yeah.
These environmental genetic confounders that you can't characterize. Okay, so what did the study show? I want to actually take you through what is called the unadjusted analysis first. So when they just literally divided the mothers into those that took paracetamol and those that didn't, they actually looked at 2.5 million children. And this is what I love about the Swedes. They really have an amazing database, really properly collected data over a prolonged period of time. So 1995 to 2019, just over 180,000 pregnancies or mothers were exposed to paracetamol, and then the remainder were not. And when you look at it like that, this is the interesting thing. The rate of autism in the paracetamol group was 3.2%, but the rate of autism in the non-paracetamol group was 2.7%. So although the difference is small, it is definitely higher in the paracetamol group. The same thing was seen in ADHD, 6.9% in the paracetamol group versus 5.8% in the non-paracetamol group. And finally, intellectual disability, 1% in both groups. So no big difference. And this is what all the previous studies have demonstrated. And people almost sort of stopped there and said, oh, look, taking paracetamol increases your risk of having children with autism. The other thing they did was they looked at the three different layers in terms of low dosing, medium dosing, and high dosing. And again, when they looked at it without doing any adjustments, the more paracetamol a mother took during the pregnancy, the higher the risk of their children developing autism. So much so that the risk almost doubled between no use and high dosing.
Can I ask, did any of these studies look at the indication for the paracetamol consumption? Because there's a huge difference there between taking it for fever, taking it for backache, taking it for all of those things.
So this study did.
Okay.
And this is why I love this study. So what I have quoted you so far was not taking any of this into account. They've also did another further analysis where they looked at so many different other potential confounders, including the indication for taking paracetamol. Let me list them out because I think it's really, really important. So they adjusted for biological sex of the child. They looked at the birthing parent's diagnosis of migraine, chronic pain, infections, fevers, rheumatoid arthritis, headaches, and any other analgesic use, aspirin, non-aspirin, anti-pain medication, opioids, and also anti-migraine medication. They also looked at parity, the birthing order of that particular child. They looked at the parent's age at delivery, the country of birth, the residential region, cohabitation at delivery, whether the parents were together or not, early pregnancy, body mass index, smoking, whether the birthing parents had autism or not, ADHD or not, history of other psychiatric disorders or not, or conditions, and the birthing parents' prescription use of other medications as well, including antidepressants, anti-seizure medications, and they also then included the sibling control factors. So once they have included all of these issues that also may determine outcome, they found that there is absolutely no relationship between paracetamol intake and the risk of autism. Even the dose-response relationship, meaning that the higher paracetamol you take, the more likely you're going to develop autism, completely disappeared. And they really concluded, which was good, showing that when you actually have a large-scale study that is really rigorous in terms of its methodology, that it's taken into account a lot of other factors, you actually see that the relationship between the usage of paracetamol and the development of autism is not there.
No.
And that's the message that needs to go out, that it's okay to take.
It's a similar story with the epidural side of things. So in October 2020, a study came out that was looking at a Californian integrated healthcare system data. And they showed an association between epidural pain relief in labor and a hazard ratio of 1.37. So that you were like 37% more likely to have a child with autism spectrum disorder if you had an epidural in labor. And everybody went wild because it was just not borne out in what we were seeing in day-to-day medicine. And there was a lot of furore and all of the obstetric anesthesia and obstetric subspecialty bodies came out with statements saying that, showing all of the limitations in the paper. Now, we know that 40 to 80% of autism spectrum disorder is potentially related to genetics. OK. What did they not control for in the study?
Genetics.
Like whether or not the parents or a sibling had a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. It was just cracked, you know. But they had, like, I think they had looked at like hundreds of thousands of people. But without controlling for that one, the one fact that we have on autism spectrum disorder is that there is a strong genetic component to it. And they completely ignored it. So there was absolute ructions about it. And then there was a series of studies that were done addressing these shortfalls. And there was contradictory data, contradictory outcomes in some of those studies. And then the cleaner and cleaner they got in terms of accounting for different issues, it was minimizing further and further and further the contribution that any epidural would have in labor related to a later diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. And when they started to show, to completely debunk any link, it was always a limitation that they lacked the power in the study size to exclude a very small effect or a tiny contributing effect of an epidural to a later diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. So again, Finland, Norway and Sweden to the rescue. So these are countries who have universal free healthcare. Okay, so they're getting all of the socioeconomic groups into the same database. Their data capture is very clear, very unified and very automated. So they looked at 4.5 million mother-baby groups. And they followed these babies from birth until their mid-teens. They dealt with the familial confounders by using sibling comparisons. So, and they ensured that both siblings had exactly the same genetic parents. So half siblings excluded, all of that. So 4.5 million mother baby units were looked at. 49% were female, 51% were male, typical population. 24% of those patients availed of epidurals. So this is coming back. So they gathered data from kind of the late 90s through, and their epidural rates were going up. Now, their epidural rates are not as high as other countries, say Western Europe and definitely North America. They just have a different culture in their pain relief choices. So they had 1 million mother baby units who availed of an epidural. And in that 1 million units, the risk of autism spectrum disorder was 1.2% and the risk of ADHD diagnosis was 4%. That gave an adjusted hazard ratio of 1.12, so 12% increase, and adjusted hazard ratio of 1.2 for ADHD. So 1.12 for ASD, 1.2 for ADHD. That's before they started cleaning it up. So what it, you know, if you leave it there, it's nearly like the other studies that hadn't actually appropriately started cleaning the data. So when they actually added in the sibling comparison data, and this is where it's really important. Again, they brought it down to if you had, if the mother had an epidural and was diagnosed with, and the baby was diagnosed with subsequently with ASD or ADHD, they then found a sibling where the mother did not have an epidural. So same genetic background. And then looked at ADSD or ADHD diagnosis. And once they added those in, it went down to nothing. So autism spectrum disorder of the adjusted hazard ratio was 0.93. And ADHD diagnosis of the adjusted hazard ratio, once you brought in the sibling data, was 0.99. So that means the closer it is to one, essentially means that there's no difference. So please, there is no association between having an epidural for labour pain relief and a subsequent diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder or ADHD.
So I like that there was a common theme in the two studies that we have done. Pain relief during the pregnancy is okay with paracetamol.
With paracetamol, yeah.
And pain relief during labor is okay with an epidural.
Yeah.
It or the risk of autism.
Autism spectrum disorder and actually for ADHD with epidurals.
Yeah. And I think it's lovely that we were able to summarize those two studies for you. And I hope it clarifies. And if mums that are listening that are considering, you know, their pain relief options, knowing this information.
Especially if they already have a child who carries one of these diagnoses.
Yes.
It's really, really, really important.
Yeah.
And I just, again, it illustrates how it's easy for media to pick up on sensationalist headlines and say, oh, epidurals contribute to the risk of autism. Paracetamol in pregnancy. Don't take it. You'll give your child autism. I don't see any headlines coming through going, take paracetamol in pregnancy. It won't give your child autism. Like, you never hear the rest of it.
That's not a sensational enough headline.
It's not interesting. There's no clickbait in that.
But that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Debunking the clickbait.
Yes. So we hope that you've enjoyed this episode and you found it of value. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to go and have a temper tantrum at home because you never got me a present for our wedding anniversary.
I'll step over you and ignore you.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.